Welcome to the Honestly Carly podcast, the truth about staying strong, sane, and seen in midlife. This is the podcast where fitness, hormone health, and real life collide, hosted by me, Carly Corrigal, midlife PT and former lawyer. I'm here with honest conversations about what it actually takes to feel incredible over 40, because yep, that's still possible. Hello, lovely people, and welcome to this week's episode of the Honestly Carly podcast. I am your host, as ever, Carly Corrigal. And this week, I have a really special guest. Now, I haven't actually had a special guest for ages, but anyway, I have Laura Murphy on the pod this week. Now, Laura is a sleep specialist, occupational therapist, and she is the founder of The Sleep Shift. And one of the things I loved about our chat, and I love about Laura full stop, is that she is so passionate about challenging this idea that as women in midlife, we should just accept that our sleep is going to be rubbish. Instead, she helps us really understand what is going on. And I'm talking beyond the kind of traditional archetypal, oh, your hormones are in flux, you're going to have night sweats, etc. And just figure out what we need to do, practical, simple things that you can do tonight to feel like you again. Because God knows, when you've had a great night's sleep, you just feel like a new woman, don't you? Anyway, without further ado, here is our conversation. Welcome, Laura Murphy, to the Honestly Carly podcast. Thank you for coming on.
It's really exciting to be here as an avid listener myself.
It's lovely to have you. And you know what? I've wanted to have you on for a while. I was gearing up to asking you because I just love, if you don't follow Laura on social media, she's at Sleep Shift, is that right?
Yeah.
On Instagram. I'll put it all in the show notes. But her stuff is an absolute goldmine of information for anyone that has ever struggled with sleep or is just kind of in that zone at the moment, because it feels a bit desperate, doesn't it, I think, when you're in the thick of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I wanted to actually start with you, because when I was doing all my background research, like, Laura's looking really nervous now. She's like, what are you going to say? But I saw that originally, because you're an occupational therapist, right?
Yeah.
And sleep wasn't necessarily where you started, but I noticed that you'd said on your site that it was something that you'd experienced yourself through poor sleep. So I wanted to ask you about that first and foremost, really, your experience with sleep.
Yeah. So it wasn't. I come from a mental health background. So I worked for well over a decade in psychiatric services. So I was in inpatient hospitals, crisis care, trauma-informed care. But sleep, as you can imagine, was one of the central conversations, topics, challenges for people with mental health difficulties. And I'd always been interested in it, because now I know more about sleep. I look back and as a child, even, and into my teenage years, I had what I now know as a delayed sleep phase disorder, basically. I was a classic night owl, and my sister is very similar. We would be up for hours into the night, and then we'd be sleeping for hours through the day.
Wow.
And then throughout my adulthood, mainly when I was a shift worker, I had challenges sleeping.
Yes, surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And that was where it really hit me. And then I'm now 41. So I experience the challenges around sleep myself, waking in the night. You know, it's never a smooth ride, especially for women. And I was just so interested in it. I really felt that it's such, and I say it on my Instagram, I say it to people I work with, sleep is so foundational. As an occupational therapist, I look at what are the barriers to you living your life, how you want to be living it. And sleep is so fundamental to that, that I actually realized, oh, if I start there, I could be more proactively helping people so that they don't then get to the point where they're really, really struggling with mental health, physical health, and so on. So I niched into that, and I was just like, yeah, this is where I'm at. This is what I love. I can really make a change here. And then, yeah, work for myself now and talk about sleep a lot.
Love it. Do you think then, just going back to what you were saying about this kind of idea of maybe sleep changing throughout your life, is there such a thing as being a poor sleeper? Because I hear women come to me all the time and they're like, I've always been a poor sleeper. Is that a thing?
Yeah. I mean, the term like I'm a poor sleeper, I'm a bad sleeper, I'm an insomniac, I do steer people away from. But there is a reality to the fact that some people are more prone to having difficulties with sleep in their life. And one of those factors that can make you more prone is actually being a woman.
Okay.
So you're going to, you know, with the people you work with, you're going to hear it a lot. And that's purely, you know, one basis of that is hormones. So, you know, we have hormone fluctuations all the time throughout every month. We are then having babies, so pregnancy, postpartum, then menopause. We have a lot of challenges that make us more prone, but also things like genetics, lifestyle factors, other health conditions, you know, so it's all a complex picture, basically.
Yeah.
But you can, the likelihood can be increased with certain people.
Okay, that's really inspiring to know. I'm sure everyone listening is like, it's no, not a lost cause, because that's often what I hear. No. And it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think, I mean, this is why I work with women, because I think we're so much more interesting and nuanced than men.
Yes.
But it does come with the challenges. It's like a double-edged sword. We get to have, you know, this really varied lifespan with lots of different changes and complexities and nuances, and it makes us, it's so great in so many ways, but sometimes our biology does feel like it's a little bit kind of working against us. And as you know, this is a podcast for midlife women. So I'd love to delve in a little bit to what those changes are specifically in midlife that, firstly, that affect our sleep, and secondly, the sort of common things that maybe you see in practice from clients who are in this phase of their lives.
Yeah. So a classic one is midlife, you're in what's sort of been termed like the sandwich generation. Mm. So put aside any other thing, you know, most women of this age have children, but their parents are aging. Plus they're trying to still work. A lot of people trying to work full time. They're trying to, you know, in this current day, you know, everything is a challenge. Things are getting more expensive. Yeah. It's harder to meet all those, you know, responsibilities when everything's going on. So you've first of all got that, which increases levels of stress, and stress impacts sleep.
Yeah,
you know, increases anxiety. Just the pressure of life can lead us to struggle to sleep at night. Then you've got hormonal changes coming in. You've got perimenopause, late 30s into your 40s, 50s. There is so much flux in terms of your hormone levels. And we talk about this sort of downward trend in your estrogen, progesterone that people know about, but actually it's way more complex than that. They're going up and down constantly. And your estrogen particularly is linked to every organ has some link to estrogen.
Yeah.
But your circadian drive for sleep is linked to your estrogen levels. So your circadian drive is my need for sleep. Is sort of timed on this rhythm. And if your estrogen levels are up and down, your drive for sleep is going to be up and down. So it becomes more challenging when, in the grand scheme of things, people say to me, you know, nothing particularly is stressing me out. Nothing's different. I'm sleeping some nights, not others. It can be so different. And that makes them feel so out of control.
Yeah.
And actually, it's this internal flux that they can't see. And sometimes you can't feel the exact flux going on. And with that era of life, you know, it's not just that, it brings changes in other sort of physiology, you know, pain is different. Women start to get classic hot flushes at night, mm-hmm. night sweats, but also things like tinnitus. And then you've got sleep disorders. The risk of sleep disorders increases in midlife. So you might have insomnia, but you can also get things like sleep disordered breathing, sleep apnea, which is where you actually stop breathing.
Yeah,
classically linked that to men, middle-aged men. But actually in midlife, women are way more at risk of sleep apnea. Yeah. It's highly underdiagnosed.
Wow.
For women. So, you know, it's going to impact your sleep. So then it's things like more headaches, brain fog, can be sleep apnea, as well as menopause, excessive daytime sleepiness, tiredness. So it becomes a really complex picture in this era of life that often women are like, nothing makes sense anymore. And I'm being controlled by my sleep or everything, where actually you can take back control. It's just understanding who can help you do that, basically. And the multiple people that can do that.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. And I think that feeling of control in so many, it's going to resonate with so many people listening, I'm sure, but you feel so out of control. And I think often, you know,
we're women who have spent our lives kind of getting to know our bodies and getting to know what works for us. And then suddenly it's like, all bets are off. Sorry, that doesn't work anymore. And I've been through periods of really poor sleep in my life, as I think probably everyone, even if you think of yourself as a quote unquote good sleeper. And it feels like in your back of your mind, you're like, someone somewhere is leading a parallel life and it's way better than mine because they're getting sleep. And if only I got the sleep, it's not for the want of trying. And sometimes, and I'm sure we'll come onto this, but the more you focus and obsess on it, it's that paradox, isn't it? The worse it can become. But I'm sure we're going to come into this. I wanted to move into a little bit of that kind of spiral. And why is it that sometimes, you know, you start off with one bad night and you'd think, okay, I've had a bad night's sleep, so I'm going to be really shattered and I'm going to sleep better the next night. But it doesn't really work that way, does it? Always. Sometimes it does, but why does one night become 10?
Yes. Yeah. A few different things can go on, but a typical thing that we'll all do is, I've had a bad night or a couple, so I'm going to change what I do. One, because I'm really, really tired. I'm sleep deprived. So my mood is lower. My anxiety is higher. My stress levels are higher. I also don't have the energy and motivation to do all the things that I know could help me sleep. So things like exercise, movement, eating well, all is impacted by having one or two bad nights sleep. It happens that quickly. We start to think, I'll go to bed a bit earlier if I can, or we start to put pressure on ourselves to go, I will go to bed earlier. And when that doesn't actually happen, it's added stress and pressure and sense of failure that we put on ourselves. It's like, I've not done it again. And that will only raise anxiety, or what we call hyperarousal, which is just your brain and your body are in a heightened state of awareness and activity. How are you going to sleep well when your whole body is in that state? So it becomes this sort of cycle that we get caught up in. And it's about just, as what I do is kind of, I break down with people those patterns. And how are you going to try and stay in some sort of routine? How are you going to get yourself moving? You don't have to go do that hard workout as such, but you know more than anyone really just how important movement is. If you can just move your body in some way, instinctively that can help you feel better. You start to actually then want to move more. It improves mood, anxiety levels go down, you can sleep better, and so on.
Yeah, I think it's so easy, isn't it? And I hear this so much from my clients. You know, they're like, I had a shit night, I'm not doing anything today. And I'm always saying, okay, what would be the smallest thing that you could do to get yourself moving? Because it just starts that spiral. Because it's also, you know, as you say, it's not just about kind of moving so you feel tired at the end of the day, which I think sometimes is where we jump. We're like, well, I'm tired enough as it is. Why do I want to wear myself out by doing more exercise? But it's often the fact that, you know, it's working with your brain chemistry. And if you're then not getting your movement in, which is stress busting and making you feel better and less anxious and more relaxed and happier, you're kind of feeding into that as well, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of our best ways to, I talk about completing the stress cycle. So like you said, we know it helps us with stress. It's a case of, you know, we're designed to be in stress states at some points in our day because it helps us do things. Actually, we need, you know, the demon is now cortisol, isn't it? It's everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
Media. It's responsible for
a lot. I'm always afraid to,
But actually, cortisol is what gets us up in the morning.
Yeah.
It helps you wake. It helps you get up. It helps you move. It helps you respond to the important things, get things done. It helps you, you know, your child's about to fall off in front of a car, you know, fall off the pavement. You respond. That's cortisol. It's helping us stay alive and do things. But we're also designed to come out of that state. So we complete a stress cycle. You go in and you come out. That's one cycle done. And so what I sort of help a lot of people is understand how to do that. And movement and exercise is one of the best ways. You get rid, you literally use up all of the chemicals that have been sent to your muscles through a stress response. If you don't use them up, if you don't move those muscles, it's stored in your body. So you stay in that state of stress. And then without realizing it, you know, your brain is saying, okay, we still haven't finished yet. So I'll stay, I'll stay alert, I'll stay awake, I'll stay focused. And that is the way we eat, sort of that tired but wired feeling.
Oh, yeah.
I'm exhausted, but your brain can't switch off because you haven't completed your stress cycle for the day. So it's not going to relax, not going to rest, it's not going
to
sleep.
Yeah. It's so interesting to me. I think it's just fascinating because I sort of almost intuitively do that. But it's taken me a long time to get into that zone of doing it, you know. I think it's really challenging for people. The other thing I hear is that people can nod off amazingly on the sofa. You know, they'll be like 40 minutes into a Netflix episode and then suddenly their partner will be like, should we just turn this off because you're asleep? And they're like, oh. And then the second they get into bed, it's like they're wide awake. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning in their brain. What is that going on there?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things there. Often the sofa is a place of less pressure to sleep. You're comfy. Like you say, we're watching something. It's really passive activity. The lights are probably lower. It's a comfy sofa. You fall asleep. So 40 minutes later, like you say, which it often is, you're into a sleep cycle. And you're sleeping. So you're using up your need for sleep. And then you go off to bed and wide awake because the bed is a different environment and your brain needs to understand where you sleep. If you're constantly falling asleep on the sofa, your brain goes, this is where I fall asleep. This time, this place, that's sleep for me. You get into bed, you're slightly more awake because you've had 40 minutes already. And then you're in bed where you've probably done this a few times. So you've repeated that pattern where the brain goes, oh, I know what we do. Yeah, sleep on the sofa, get to bed, think about stuff. It's all so association based. It's all patterns. Our brain just loves a repeat pattern. It learns it and it repeats it for you. It thinks it's helping you. And what you need to do, and I work with people a lot, is how do you push through that dozing on the sofa so that your need for sleep is really high when you get into bed and you can retrain the brain to understand that's where you sleep. And the sofa becomes a place of relaxation, but not that instinctive dosing at that time.
And it's such a nice feeling. It's so easy to succumb, isn't it? But I want to go back to what you just said there, because it's something I really wanted to touch on, is this need for sleep, this drive for sleep. So where does that come from? How do we set that up beautifully so it kind of it kicks in when it needs to? And does that mean that naps are off the... I mean, I'm not a napper. I'm not somebody who... when my kids were tiny and everyone goes, sleep when the baby sleeps, I could never do that. But I've always been slightly jealous of people that can. But is that a help or a hindrance when it comes to your nighttime sleep?
Yeah, very good question and really common. So firstly, what builds our sleep, there's two main processes going on. So you've got one, which is circadian rhythm. Lots of people will have heard of that now, but it's essentially your internal body clock, your internal time. And everything is based around a circadian rhythm. Circadian just simply means around the day. So around 24 hours, every single part of your body, every cell, every organ has its own little clock. And it's timing away to this 24-hour rhythm of keeping you alive and functioning. And one of the most important ones there is sleep and wake. We are generally still set to being awake in the day when it's light and being asleep at night when it's dark. And there are variations in that. We don't all have the same circadian rhythm. We are all individual. And that's where the whole night owl early bird comes from. It's called a chronotype. That's your natural preference around that. So that's your own circadian cycle. And so you will know your own. Life gets in the way. But if we delve deep enough, which is what I do, you know, question, we can work it out. And then you try and align it with social time, the world, the clock that the world is on, that we all have to live by. And we try and get those to match as much as possible. But obviously, we have to be realistic about that. Then you have what's called sleep drive or sleep pressure. And that's a chemical buildup in your body, which is the chemical called adenosine, which it basically creates sleepiness. And when you have certain levels of that, your need for sleep is high. It's sleepiness. So that linked to what you do is really important to know,
because adenosine is a waste product from using your energy system. So like GCSE biology always comes back here and the ATP system, and the A is adenosine. It's left over from being alive, doing things. And the more you do, the more adenosine you're going to create in your system, the sleepier you're going to be. We want your levels of adenosine, your sleep drive, to be really high at the time that you want to be sleeping. So you link the two. Circadian rhythm wise, I generally want to be asleep, you know, 11 p.m., let's say. Mm-hmm. So you, by 11 p.m., want your sleep drive to be really high. The two come together. And then in an ideal world, you'll sleep. That's where napping comes in. Napping, it fits circadian, the rhythm, your circadian. In the afternoon, you have a natural circadian dip, and then it rises again. And then at night, you have your next one for sleep. So napping, it can be great if you fit it in your natural afternoon dip. And then if you keep it short, because if you sleep for too long, it's going to steal your sleep drive. Okay. From the night ahead. So generally speaking, there's been quite a bit of research on it now. 20 to 30 minutes is great.
Okay.
It also means you stay in light sleep. We sleep in different stages. People will see on trackers and things like that. Light sleep is the sort of first stage of sleep that we enter. 20 to 30 minutes, you'll stay in that. It means it's much easier to wake from. If you go further than 30 minutes, you're really likely to go into deep sleep. That's where, if you wake from that, you get that grogginess.
Yeah.
It's sleep inertia, we call it. Groggy, foggy, can't get going again. You just want to sleep more. So it's like, there's always caution around napping, let's say. It can be a great way to boost energy, focus for a good few hours, but you've got to be careful if you do struggle to sleep at night.
Okay. That's so interesting. I don't feel like I'm missing out too much, but, you know, I wouldn't beat myself up if I just had that little 20 minutes shut eye in the afternoon. Were I ever to have the time for it? It's so interesting. That circadian rhythm, why is it then? And this is another thing I hear so much from the women that come to work with me, that they're waking up so early in the morning. And there's sort of two, I see, and you know, I don't know if you're, I'm sure it is, because you see way more women about sleep than I do, but two kind of camps. There's those that are waking at kind of 3 a.m. and immediately it's like the brain is on and we are going through the whole Rolodex of things we've got to do that day. Or they're saying, I'm awake, you know, when it's light outside and it's sort of far before my alarm's due to go off. I'm still tired, but I'm kind of awake for the day. And it's not necessarily an anxious feeling at that point, but it is that very much like, I feel like I'm awake before I should be. What's going on there with, is that a circadian rhythm thing?
A few different things. Mm. But one can be linked to your circadian rhythm. In this midlife era, our estrogen levels fluctuate. Estrogen is really strongly linked to your circadian rhythm. We call it a consolidated circadian rhythm, means you've got this nice rhythmic pattern day after day after day. It's really robust. It's a solid, yes, I feel sleepy at this time and I wake at this time. When your estrogen levels are fluctuating and when they're dipping, the circadian rhythm can go off and it can seem really unjust. You're like, hang on a minute, why am I suddenly awake at 5 a.m. I don't want to be, and I've done everything I should have done. That's internally, there's stuff going on hormonally that can lead to that. It can also be, so going back to cortisol, your cortisol levels can raise, and they start to, cortisol will raise to help you wake. So if you're in a nice, consistent pattern of sleep, your body knows, okay, Carly wakes at 6 a.m. every day. A couple of hours before that, we'll start reducing the melatonin that she's got flooding around her system that's helping her sleep, or no to sleep. And we'll start upping the cortisol. She needs that to wake. That can start to shift with that circadian confusion that's going on with the flux of hormones. So it's signaling in the way it thinks is right. You know, circadianly, oh, I'm doing the right thing, but actually it's the wrong time. For what you're hoping for.
Yeah.
It can also be stress. You know, there's a lot going on in life. And if there's sort of less time and capacity to manage stress in the day,
sleep, you can't hide anything from sleep. Sleep is where it shows all of that. You think, oh, it's fine, I'm dealing with it, it's all okay. But those wakings in the night can be an indication of, let's look more at how you're coping with that stress in the day and finding your little strategies, moments in the day to help manage that. And the night wakings tend to calm down.
Okay. Yeah, it's almost as though you haven't given your brain that time to process whatever it's dealing with in the day. So it goes, great, it's quiet now. We'll have a good old think about all those things and problem solve. It's just finding that outlet, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And at night, so people love when I tell them this because it starts to make so much sense. Why does stuff always feel worse at night? You wake up the next day and you're like, I don't know why I was worried about that. That's just ridiculous. What, you're such an idiot. What was you worried about? But at night, we've got the prefrontal cortex, sits right behind your forehead here. And that's the part of the brain that makes sense of everything. Okay. It rationalizes everything. It's your executive functioning center, basically. I'll plan, I'll strategize, got everything in hand. That also sleeps at night. It does all its restoration at night. Blood flow says, nope, we're not feeding you, we're going elsewhere. And so at night, you're left with that thinking and the emotions of, what about this? Got to do that. But the bit of your brain that says it's okay, you can do this, you've got it in hand, this is the plan, isn't switched on. So,
oh God, this news to me. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So you're left just going, oh, this feels awful. I feel so out of control. I feel worried. I feel panicked. And then in the day, everything's switched back on again in the front and it goes, it's all okay. You can do this.
Wow. That's so, definitely don't start like I do composing emails in your brain during the morning. That's, the prefrontal cortex is not on. We're not on. Not the time. That's interesting. Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's fascinating. And I think what I'm taking so much from what you're saying, which I'd never thought of before, is how your body's always trying to help you. It's always actually, it gets it wrong quite a lot of the times. Sometimes. Yeah. Actually, everything, it's not, we so often talk about, I feel like my body's working against me, but actually it's working with the tools that it's got, right? It's trying to find your rhythm. It's like, oh, I thought you wanted to do it this way because this is how we've been doing it. And it's like, it's slow to get the memo, but actually, you know, like switching off the prefrontal cortex, and it's just trying to work the most efficient kind of well-oiled machine. But it's almost like a ChatGPT that's been fed the wrong stuff. It's like, you've given it the wrong program.
Yeah. So sleep is a biological need. People say, oh, I never sleep, don't get any sleep. You're alive, so you are sleeping. Yeah. Yes, it might be absolutely crap, but you are. We cannot survive without sleep. It's the same as air, water, food, sleep. You can actually survive longer without food than you can without sleep.
Really?
But we've normalized sleep deprivation in our culture. In our society, we talk about it all the time. And, you know, oh, I haven't slept. No, I haven't slept either. I'm waking too. What are you doing for it? What are you doing? But actually what that's doing is it's perpetuating the issue because we're all basically accepting it because we're all doing it and struggling with it and thinking, well, you know, just got to put up with it. Or I've tried this, tried that's not working. Oh, well, this is just me. And, you know, you said earlier about, are there such things as poor sleepers?
Yeah.
We convince ourselves because we just come to a level of acceptance. Whereas I say to people, you don't have to accept it. There are things you can, as a parent with children that are waking, even with illnesses and so on, there are ways you can get better sleep. You don't have to put up with it.
Yeah, it's so cool. And a seamless segue into what things we can do. I wanted to start, I've got a whole list. She consults a list of things that I've been told might help my sleep. I wanted to start with one that you actually mentioned when we were chatting about circadian rhythm, which is melatonin. And I know I've got listeners who are not in the UK who may be able to get melatonin from their pharmacies and stuff. And, you know, I know people here can get them sometimes. What if you're taking melatonin, is that the same melatonin you're producing naturally? And what does melatonin do and what doesn't it do?
Yes. So this is a really, really good topic because we confuse what melatonin actually is, what it does, and if we do or don't need it. Most of us, let's say, produce melatonin naturally. Yes, there are some people that don't, and that's detected at a medical level, and then it can be replaced synthetically. Okay. Most of us actually do produce our own, but we can block the release of it.
Oh.
Melatonin is important because it's part of that circadian rhythm where in the lead up to going to sleep, so if you're in a consistent pattern, once again, Carly goes to sleep around 11 p.m., right? A couple of hours before that, I ideally want to be releasing melatonin because melatonin, it prepares your body for sleep. It doesn't create sleepiness. It's not what we would call a soporific, something that creates sleepiness. It's running around your body once it's released, basically as this messenger going, Carly wants to sleep soon, get ready, you know, do what you need to do. We've got a couple of hours. You better get on with it. And melatonin is released in response to your eyes detecting darkness.
Right.
It's part of that pattern. In the day, I'm meant to be awake. So if I get light in my eyes, I will stop melatonin being produced. If you've still got any running around, I know it's daytime, we don't need it. If eyes detect darkness, nighttime's coming. You know, sun setting, going to dusk, darkening, that melatonin's going to be naturally released and do what it needs to do to help you feel ready for sleep around the time and stay asleep until it then gets the signal of then needing to wake. So it's highly likely most people that think, oh, I need to take melatonin, are somehow maybe just blocking the release of their own natural melatonin. It could be that they are exposed to too much light late at night because life happens. You know, they're having to clean up the house, the lights are on, they're having to still do some work that they haven't finished off in the day. So they're still in that mode of daytime. And again, our body's trying to do the right thing, but we're giving it the wrong signals.
Okay.
We're telling it it's day when actually what it needs to understand is it's night. And I just help people understand you can still do certain things that you have to get done, but just think about the environment, think about the signals you're sending to your brain that will still have you ready around the time you want to sleep. When people start to take melatonin as a supplement, it's synthetic melatonin. It's not the same, but it basically mimics like a lot of these synthetic supplements and things, but it can be, there's still not the research that really tells us, okay, does this impact on you, the production of your own natural melatonin or not? We don't know whether in the real long term it could impact. So you start to produce less natural melatonin.
Yeah.
But what we do know is if you take too much, and my God, if you go to the US, you can see ridiculous strength melatonin on those shelves that people are like popping like nobody's business. You actually only need a very, very small amount if you do. And the trouble is it's your body will naturally stop its melatonin release when it needs to get you to wake and do things in the day. If you take it synthetically, it can stay in your system until it's metabolized.
Okay.
It doesn't get that signal to stop. It's just there until it runs out. So lots of people actually find that, okay, it might have got me to sleep and I've had some sleep, but now I'm groggy. The morning, that lag that carries on for a few hours is really significant. And so it starts to affect daytime functioning in a different way. And essentially it's not resolving really probably what your actual issue when it comes to sleep is. It's sort of it doesn't always work and it's not often needed.
That's so interesting. You know, you can buy blue light blocking glasses for your phone and all kinds of other things. So how does this link in with sort of screen time and being on a screen late in the evenings, or is it about getting out and getting daylight in the morning, or is it sort of a combination of those things?
Yeah, it's all of those. So the circadian rhythm that I said about, it's around 24 hours, it means, because it is around. Actually, naturally, our internal circadian rhythm isn't the same as the 24-hour clock.
Okay.
Some of us run slightly under that, some over. So what we need to do is we need to sync it with the external environment. And one of the most powerful ways of doing that syncing, it's called entrainment, is through light. One of the most powerful ways to tell your brain. We've got this little nucleus, which I call the control center, basically, the circadian control center, that sits behind the eyes. And we've got these light-detecting cells in our retina. That their job is basically to detect, is there light or not? And it sends messages then to that control center to say, I detect light, it must be day. So switch on all the daytime functions, get all of that going. And when we detect darkness, it says, ah, we're going into the night. We sleep then, turn it around, do all the nighttime stuff, get ready for sleep and so on. So light can be a fantastic way. If you think I'm off here, my sleep is off, I've got no rhythm going on. If you spend a couple of weeks just focusing on when you wake up, you get up, and within an hour, just try and get light in your eyes. And that, yeah, I mean, you're going to get the best light if you go outside. Natural light is the most powerful light. It's the strongest. Yeah, even on a cloudy, rainy day, it's going to be, you know, so much more powerful than any fake light. But it could be sit by your window. It can be open the back door and just stand there for a few minutes. Just breathe everything in, but open your eyes. Let the light go in. You can help boost how you feel. It switches stuff on. You will start to feel more alert, more energized, ready for the day. It can also help you get through if you are someone that sort of feels that afternoon snooze coming on, but you just can't. Light, movement, get outside, do things. They're all signals that will tell your brain, no, keep going, stay awake. And then at night, letting the darkness signals hit your eyes. And the blue light is quite, more research now is showing us what we used to believe is actually incorrect. It used to be, you know, blue light, which is naturally morning light. So of course it is a signal to your brain to say it's day, wake up. But the signals that you get from your phone and devices is not strong enough to really override this, the timings, the circadian timings. The research now shows that's not the case. You would have to be in complete darkness for hours before and then bright device light for at least 30 minutes to an hour for it to delay any signals. So the blue light blocking glasses, I mean, it's something sold to a lot of us. But actually, it's not going to be really making a difference. And it's not going to override you doing all the other things that block your sleep. Just because you're wearing blue light blocking glasses, but you haven't done your exercise, you're really highly stressed, you're not implementing any kind of routine around your sleep wake, it's not going to override any of that. And then you said about screen time in general. Ignore the blue light thing. It's not going to impact your sleep, but what you're doing on your phone is.
Okay. So now we're getting to it.
Yeah. We all know, you know it. If we're honest with ourselves, we know the way I'm using my phone, is this helping me sleep or is this not? And it's a case of, it's unrealistic for any of us to think I can detach from my phone completely and I can put it away and I can be that perfect person. They're designed so cleverly. We're all addicted, let's be honest. So I never say to someone, don't use your phone. It's more a conversation around how are you using it? What settings, what apps, what are you looking at? Is it work related? Is it emails or is it, no, I actually use my Calm app because I listen to something on that or a podcast or something that's actually helping you end that day in a more relaxed, calm way that's sort of transitioning you into sleepy state rather than feeding the active day state of mind, which is usually like panic, get things done, do. That's when the real change happens, if you can readjust how you're using it, rather than anything to do with filters and all of that, but you're still looking at work emails,
etc. That's so interesting, because I think that is probably, I don't know, maybe one of the strongest misconceptions perhaps about sleep and how device work, you know, what it does to our sleep. Because I have this conversation week in, week out, you know, I know I'm really naughty, I'm always scrolling before bed, and I know the light will be stopping me sleeping, and I've got these, I'm going to buy these glasses or activate this mode on my phone. And it's just so interesting that that's just not enough. It's that, it's not really neither here nor there, but actually if our brains are super active and we're kind of in day mode, then it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, the other thing on talking about technology that comes up so much are sleep trackers. So whether it's a Whoop band or an Oura Ring or just your good old Apple Watch or your Garmin, and telling you, is it ever useful to track our sleep, or, and are they accurate?
Yeah. So Generally, they're not as accurate as we would like them to be for the way we're all using them and sort of using them to guide us, basically. So they are great in other areas of life, like, you know, looking at heart rate and zones in your training, brilliant. But when it comes to sleep, you can't measure your sleep off your wrist or off a ring. Okay. Or nearables, as they call them, which is something you might put on your bed or next to the bed. They're limited readings. So lots of them are looking at like movement and heart rate, sometimes breathing rate. They are only a couple of the measures that you would use to really know what stage of sleep someone's in. Are they asleep? Are they not? Are they in light, deep, or REM sleep, which is where we do a lot of our dreaming? You can only detect that through polysomnography, which is a lab test, basically. Polysomnography means multiple testing. Okay. It's taking multiple readings, and one main one is electrodes on your head. It's measuring electrical activity of the brain, which is really what tells us, in conjunction with all the sort of temperature and breathing rates and movement, yes, and things like that. It puts together the whole picture. That's the only way we can really truly know. Your watch can give you trends. So you could look at it, and if you notice, okay, I'm on kind of a downward trend here with my sleep, and it's telling me my, some of them like body battery and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would take that as a warning. Like, oh, okay, maybe I need to look at this more. Maybe I do need to think, am I getting the sleep I need? Is my sleep disrupted, or am I disrupting it? Am I limiting it? And make some adjustments, rather than what you usually get is, oh, I only had 18 minutes of deep sleep. Oh, yeah. And, oh, I feel terrible. It can't measure that. And how do you actually feel? Put your watch away. Don't look at your data. How do you feel? You know, what's your energy like? Are you feeling alert? How are you cognitively? Like, do you feel switched on? Can you do what you need to do? And emotionally, you know, are you all over the place? You think, oh, is there anything here? Yeah. Or I can't handle this stress today. They're more indications about how you're sleeping compared to what your watch is going to tell you.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, it mirrors advice that I give around heart rate zones. And if you're just using a wrist strap, it's probably very inaccurate. And actually, you know, if you feel you work really, really hard, you probably have, regardless of the fact that it got you in zone two, right? But it is so tempting. And I think it's so nice to kind of have that validation when things are going well. But also it's not finding an excuse when things feel hard. But I know certainly we're looking for that justification sometimes, especially in midlife when things are a little bit all over the shop. And we're resting about that control. And suddenly we're like, well, actually, my watch is telling me that I'm recovering really badly and my sleep is all over the place. So that must be it. I'm obviously just not sleeping as well as I think I am. Which presumably like then can start this spiral of anxiety around sleep and the quality of sleep that we're getting.
Yeah, it's really personal. We're all so different as to, you know, how much we like data, how much we read into it, what influence that has. And for some people, it can be really helpful because they go around in life being quite blasé. You know, culturally, we're still in the sort of, oh, sleep is kind of the last thing we think about. You're still a bit weak if you focus on sleep, you know. All of that rubbish. So they're limiting sleep opportunities and they think they're okay. And it can be a helpful little reminder. Oh, actually, remember sleep is an important thing as well as everything else. But for other people who are more prone to maybe focusing too much on the data, developing more of an anxiety around that actually creates more of a sleep problem. Because the one thing about sleep that's different to the other areas of health, you know, if you want to get fitter, you'd put more effort into movement and exercise and doing nutrition. You focus on it more. There's more effort put in. Sleep, you actually want to put less focus on.
Okay.
It sounds bizarre. And I know the irony of it when I say, I'm here to talk about sleep. And then I say, don't think too much about sleep.
This is for an hour of podcast about sleep.
Yeah, exactly. But what I try and do with people actually is reduce that anxiety, normalizing things, helping them understand how sleep works. And then people go, oh, it's actually not as complicated as I thought it was. I realize now this is actually like kind of blocking sleep. Or if I just shift this a little bit, I can get better sleep. And for some people, I actually have to say, can we take the tracker away. Because I have to point out the patterns that I'm noticing in terms of the anxiety it's building and how that's impacting their sleep.
Yeah, that makes sense. It really makes sense. And it's such sensible advice. I know we've talked about exercise and we've talked about this, like sleep as being part of like a jigsaw puzzle, really. But I really wanted to touch on maybe what we're eating or not eating or drinking or not drinking, you know, caffeine, alcohol. Are there foods that are going to help us? I mean, or food supplements, maybe magnesium, something of that sort of ilk that we're often sort of fed might help our sleep. Is there anything in it?
Yeah. So really commonly I'm asked these questions because what we tend to like is if I can just eat this, take that, add this in, then will that fix my sleep? Because understandably, we do want quick fixes, as we call them, you know, and we're sold them everywhere. We're surrounded by them. Will this help? Won't it? This fixed my insomnia. It's going to fix yours too. Just buy this. In general, when it comes to nutrition, if you keep a well-balanced, nutrient-dense diet, then you will help your sleep.
Yeah.
You might read articles where things like kiwis, there was a research study done on kiwis, 2 kiwis before bed and their sleep quality improved. Yes, potentially. But if those people are still really highly stressed and the wrong signals are going in at the wrong time, just having 2 kiwis...
not going to make a difference. No.
No. You've just eaten 2 kiwis and hopefully you like kiwis. Same for cherries and certain foods that include tryptophan, which is it's like a precursor to producing melatonin. But if you're just going, oh, I can't sleep. Oh, I'll eat a banana or drink a glass of milk. It's not going to create sleepiness suddenly. It's not a drug in that sense. So just generally speaking, daily life, good, nutritious diet that, you know, you can get guidance on. I do link people in with fantastic nutritionists who can really advise what they need. And then when it comes to supplements, I'm always so hesitant. One, because the supplement industry is so unregulated.
Yeah.
Scarily so.
Yeah.
It's expensive. And do you actually need it? Without good testing, you don't really know. You know, we're all so different as to what we need. We live very different lives. Our bodies are very different. So we could be spending a lot of money for it not doing anything. As a lot of people say, you know, you're just weeing out your money, basically. Yeah. When we look at magnesium, magnesium is linked to so many functions in the body. And that's why it gets confusing, because there's so many different types of magnesium. And you'll see lists and it's like, take this for that and that for that. Magnesium glycinate is linked to sort of that calming, relaxed state. It works in terms of sort of the central nervous system, has many parts to it. And it basically helps us feel more relaxed, which can help sleep.
Okay.
So there's not that direct. Again, it's not causing your sleepiness. It's creating a state where you are ready for your natural sleepiness to take hold.
Okay.
But there are three ways to do that. That, you know, when we understand the function of what that supplement's doing, you realize, oh, well, yeah, I don't need to spend this money. I can go do some movement. I can get outside. I can take 5 minutes a few times a day just to do what I need to do for me to feel calmer by the end of the day. It's very individual. And, you know, the trouble with all the information out there now is everything's so generic. We should all be taking this. We should all be doing that. And actually, it's way more personal. And so I would encourage people to speak to someone that knows what they're talking about, that can investigate it further. It might be you have blood tests, nutrition, it could be sleep, it could be GP. Don't start buying stuff until you've done that bit, because it can save you a lot in the long run.
That's such good advice. And what about going back to coffee, you know, that glass of wine in the evening that seems to make you relax and then you nod off and you're not thinking about everything, or likewise coffee. You know, for me, maybe it's a story I've told myself, but kind of midday is my cutoff for coffee. If I have it after then, I often find that I feel so awake in the evenings.
Yeah. Again, it's really personal. So caffeine, basically, it mimics the adenosine I was talking about before, but not in its sleepy way. It mimics adenosine in the way it blocks receptors. So your brain can't detect adenosine. So it thinks, I've not got any adenosine, so I'm not sleepy. And so that can happen for hours. On average, it's just under 9 hours. It can still be blocking your sleepiness for. So that's where the guidance comes. Like have a cutoff. Like 2 p.m. is often said, but goes on the time you want to be sleeping.
Okay.
Whether you're an early or late sleeper, working back from that to say, okay, well, I'll sort of stop caffeine around then to let it fully get out of my system, fully metabolize, so my brain can detect its adenosine, so I feel sleepy for sleep and can sleep. The other thing that needs to be factored in, which again is you can't know unless you're tested, is everyone has a genetic difference as to how they metabolize caffeine, how it impacts them. So without testing, what I say to people is, when you have caffeine, how does it affect you?
Yeah.
Go work it out. You know, lots of what I do with people is actually, I want to build your awareness, your learning about your body. It's not always about tips, tricks, hacks. That's not how it works.
No.
It's about how does caffeine affect you? Find that out. We'll work from that.
Okay.
Some people can have a coffee late. Yeah. It doesn't impact their sleep and they're fine.
I've got a friend who literally, you can go out for a meal with her and then they'll come around and say anything else, coffees, teas. And I'll be like, I'll have a fresh mint. And she's like, double espresso. And you think, what are you doing? But it doesn't affect her at all, seemingly. She's absolutely fine with that. Loves that as an end of an evening meal.
Yeah.
But that's her, right? Comes back to this highly individual, you know, it's just her biology and that's how she's programmed, I guess.
Yeah. Exactly. So it is, you know, more people than not will be impacted by caffeine. But if you're not, don't stress over it. If you are, you know, just find an alternative. Because what we tend to do, we're so bad at, you know, oh, I will stop doing that.
Yeah.
And then we're like, oh, but now I don't have anything. And so what do? We go back to having a coffee.
Yeah.
It's like, find something else you really like. Experiment with it. Go work that out. And then you know, this is what I do in a day to manage that, rather than just saying, no, I won't have anything. I'll just put myself in this massive hole of discomfort.
Yeah.
Life's tough as it is.
It is. And that is often what I hear from women about the alcohol thing. Because personally, again, I find, and I have been somebody who suffered with night sweats in the past. Mm-hmm. It just gives me palpitations, night sweats. I just, it seems to just not agree with me having more than like two glasses of wine. And that is like the absolute cutoff for me. And otherwise I sleep appallingly. Is this thing?
Yeah. So alcohol it affects the REM sleep that I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. So in the stages of sleep, REM sleep is rapid eye movement sleep. And that is where we do most of our dreaming. So it's often called dream sleep. And in that stage of sleep, sort of robs us of that. In that sleep, you're doing a lot of your emotional processing.
Okay.
So it's really, really important for waking up feeling like I can manage things today, my mood's okay, I can take stress on, I've got that capacity. So it's often why we're quite emotional after drinking and then not sleeping well, because we've missed that bit of sleep.
Yeah.
That's really essential. About a quarter of our night, give or take, more of a fifth, of our night is that. So you've robbed yourself of quite a bit of quality of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we're all different in how we metabolize the alcohol, how it affects us. In midlife, it's talked about quite a bit now, but you can get more of a histamine response.
Okay.
And alcohol is a big culprit when it comes to histamine. So what some women report, and I've had it myself, is suddenly, you know, a couple of years ago, I could drink something that I've drunk before, a type of gin, a wine, and suddenly I would be bunged up, my nose would be running, that histamine response kicks in. That's going to impact your sleep as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, how does alcohol affect me? What is my night like after it? What are the new things that are coming up with alcohol? Not saying no, but it's more about that choice in a state of awareness. Like, I know how alcohol affects me. I really want this drink tonight. I'm with my friends. I want to join in. Yeah. I feel like I just want it. Do. And then you know what's coming. So you can kind of accept.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I know why I had that drink. It's fine. I knew this was coming. I'll just relax into it. Don't force it. Whereas if you try and fight it, then you know, your sleep's just going to be even worse.
Yeah.
So yeah, yeah, personal choice and personal.
Yeah, because life is for living and it's up to us as grown up adults to work out how we choose to spend it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what I say to people is sleep is the ultimate form of rest. We do all our repair, restoration, everything there. But if you haven't done the other forms of rest, like exercise, socializing, doing your hobbies, getting outside, you can't sleep. So you can't put everything in the one basket of sleep. You have to have all the other elements going on to get there. Yeah. Sleep is kind of the end result of
that. I love it. It's like the product, isn't it? At the end, it's kind of the putting it all together, making that recipe that's sort of just right for you. I love that. I want to talk more about your approach because I think we've got a really good flavor of it from everything you said. But I want to talk about CBTI, what it is and how it might differ from something that somebody has tried before.
Yeah. So what we tend to see in sort of mainstream is what's termed sleep hygiene. It's a terrible, terrible name. But it's kind of like...
It's dirty sleeping alternative.
And it's not that. It's these kind of general guidelines that if you generally don't have big issues with sleep, they'll keep you on track. But actually, CBTI goes way, way deeper. It's a conversation where every element of life is taken into account. Not just sleep. Yes, we look at sleep patterns and history and everything, but it's what's also life like, what's going on for you on all different levels. And it's then working out what's the real crux of this issue. What is driving these sleep issues? Sleep itself generally isn't the problem because sleep wants to do its thing. For CBTI, it's working out what are the barriers, what's getting in the way of sleep. And then it's an evidence-based, it's a proven technique that is approved by NICE, which is our governance basically for health and care, as a proven strategic approach basically to supporting people with real insomnia, those real challenges. And it looks at behaviors, routines, your thinking patterns around sleep. Like I've said, sort of if you think you're sleeping badly, you can actually then cause sleeping issues.
Yeah.
And just gently, you know, what we will do is if we read a Google article that says, right, start doing this, we'll start doing it. Everything's changed really suddenly. And of course, that shocks your body. Yeah. Your circadian rhythm goes into shock and goes, whoa, now I'm not doing anything. Don't know what you want.
Yeah.
That's jet lag, where you shock your circadian
rhythm. Yeah.
You're asking it suddenly to do these things that it does at one time at another. And we all know how awful.
You
can do that to yourself if you suddenly change things. So it's a very gentle approach, which is a very collaborative process. It's about you, your life, what can work for you. There are some maybe sort of harder, stricter strategies in it. But if that doesn't suit you as a person, we don't use that. We can take other approaches. So it's very personalized. And that's usually the difference where people notice, actually, this is really changing things because it's directly about you and what will work for you over time.
Yeah, it's very bespoke, very tailored, and very much getting under the skin of whatever it is that's stopping you from sleeping. Yeah. Is there an intersection with things that are more biological? And I'm aware we haven't really touched on night sweats and hot flushes, but can it help with that as well, you know, if you're experiencing that at night? Because I see that almost as like a, and I know it's probably not, but this very physiological response rather than more of an emotional and lifestyle driven, but the two related, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a combined approach. So if you're going through something like experiencing night sweats, you need a few different people involved, really, because that's a vasomotor symptom of perimenopause. So that can be treated. Hormonal treatments and non-hormonal treatments can, you know, women report that those symptoms are reducing. But what I do on HRT now, my night sweats have stopped, but I'm still waking. Like, what is going on? And that's where CBTI can really work through the pattern that has formed.
Got you.
The routine that like I said before, your brain has gone, ah, we wake at this time. Right, I'll help you wake. You're like, no,
yeah.
I don't need to do that anymore. But why are you still doing it? So we look at the retraining of the brain and its understanding of what it needs to do and when. And also some people come out with anxiety, like, okay, mm-hmm. it's managed, but what if it comes back? What yeah. if my sleep is impacted again? And that anxiety, CBTI is a fantastic way to sort of work through that, reduce the impact of that and get people sleeping better again whilst they're with their menopause specialist, GP, or whoever they're seeing in that sense.
Yeah, it's sort of multifaceted, isn't it, in that respect? And I was going to ask you actually how sort of quickly people tend to feel things turn around, but I think probably the more valuable question is, you know, you're then equipped with those tools, presumably, that you can carry on, and you know it isn't panic stations if suddenly you have a week of crap sleep and it all fell in a handcart.
Yeah, it's that sense of control comes back to people. So I can tell people a couple of strategies to use. You know, if you wake in the night, this is what is the recommended strategy. We'll do it in this way for you. I see them a week or two later and they go, I haven't had to use it. I've woken, but I've managed to get back to sleep fairly quickly. And it's because they felt a sense of control back. If it happens, I know what to do. And instantly they wake, they know why, because we've spoken about the likely reasons. And then they go, okay, well, if I just settle back in, and then if not, I can do that. And they're asleep again. So just knowing what you can do, if it happens, why it's happening, it improves sleep. Anyway, so, you know, quite often people can notice change in some ways really, really quickly. And then I sort of do myself out of a job in a way, because you equip people, they know what to do. They don't need to come back to you.
Graduated, they're off. I know. Yeah. Oh, I think it's just so fascinating. I want to kind of, we'll have to wrap things up, even though I could just literally chat to you about this for hours. I have so many different tangents I could go off on. What would you say is like the one thing that midlife women maybe need to hear about sleep that you don't think they're hearing enough of? If you could, it's so hard, isn't it? Like, distill everything into one little nugget.
My message, I've kind of said it, which is it doesn't have to be part of your life. Mm-hmm. The impact of poor sleep, we all know it. The days are so hard and they really don't need to be. You are trying your best to do everything and the messages are constant. You're not doing enough. You know, now you have to do, it's the constant cold plunge, sauna, where's your LED face mask? Go do this, go do that. Have you done a retreat? There's more and more that we all need to be doing. And actually we need to come back to the fundamentals. Say you'll be doing more, you'll feel better, your confidence, your drive, your motivation, just time that, you know, time will feel just it's yours again if you can get the sleep you need, rather than being in this constant battle where days and nights are hard. So I'm big for let's not normalize it. And I said to someone recently, and I think I put it on my Instagram, let's make it a radical act for women now in this day and age. Let's make sleep that radical act where we go, no, I am not staying up to do all of those things. The essentials are done. Everyone's still alive. Let's get some sleep.
Love it.
So that's really my message. I'll just keep repeating.
Brilliant.
And then it's saying to women, this is how you can get the help you need. We've put up with sleep challenges all our lives, usually, just by being a woman. It doesn't have to be that way.
I love that. And I'm so here for all of it. Speaking about helping oneself, do you mind telling everybody how they can work with you? Because I'm sure they've listened to this and gone, right, how do I get more Laura in my life? And I'll put it all in the show notes.
Okay. So mainly my work is one-to-one. So I offer different levels where if you're just curious and you just want to go, you know, if you've listened to this and you think, oh, I've got some questions, I just would like to speak to Laura just about these couple of things. I do a one-off sleep coaching session. And that's an hour where, you know, you can then go off happily. You've had your questions answered. Everything's okay. But then I do more intensive and comprehensive assessments. So if it's more serious, if it's more likely that you do actually have more of what we would term insomnia, that sort of clinical level insomnia, comprehensive assessment, and then a series of sessions afterwards. But most people, it's, you know, work together over a couple of months. And then it's about, you know, going off and embedding it. It's not something that I'll keep people coming back to me for ages. And then it might be a year later, we check back in and you crack on. But usually in the space of a couple of months, people can really notice changes enough to be getting on with things.
Brilliant. I love that. Super inspiring. There's hope, ladies. There's more than hope.
Exactly. There's more than hope.
Reclaiming sleep as this radical act. I love it. Yes. Oh my goodness. Nora, thank you so much for chatting to me today. We might need to do a part two.
Yeah, the trouble is there's so much and I could go on and on and on. So it's
there's also always a new, no, not at all. And there's also always a new trend. There's always something that pops up somewhere and people think, oh, maybe this is it. But sensible, slow, steady, incremental change sounds like absolutely the way forwards.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you for having me.
My total pleasure. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Honestly Carly. If you love today's chat, then why not share it with a friend? Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if you're feeling really kind, leave a 5-star review. I'll see you next time for more honest chat and science-backed strategy for feeling strong, confident, and capable in midlife. Have a great week.